This is Walden Ultra, day one. And we're going to start with the prayer again, since I forgot to record it the first time. This is a prayer from Thomas Aquinas, in case you didn't notice it. Slightly modified by Wong. Creator of all being and creator of all things, the true source of light and wisdom, lofty source of being, let your brilliance penetrate the darkness of my ignorance and fill my mind with light. Give me a sharp sense of understanding, a retentive memory, and the ability to grasp things correctly and fundamentally. Grant me the talent of being exact in my explanations and the ability to express myself with thoroughness and charm. Point out the beginning, direct the progress, help in the completion, and help me find you at the core of every idea I explore. Amen. Is that a prayer that anybody was familiar with? All you good Catholics?
No, but I'd like to have a copy of that. Would you send that to us?
Well, I'll try to remember. Okay, well, slight modifications, but very slight. Yes, I especially like the sentence, point out the beginning, direct the progress, and help in the completion. This is something that is lacking in modern education, especially the point out the beginning. And so, there you have it. I have on the screen, I haven't shared this, so here we go. I have on the screen a copy of In the Company of Light, which will be ready in, it's at the printer. All right, did we finish it? Did we get it?
No, we just got the printer.
Yeah, that's true. It'll be ready by the end of the week, probably. This is a collection of above the mean columns from the fifth year, which we just finished the sixth year, so I'm a year behind on this. But that's a Nicholas Roerich painting there on the cover, you might recognize. This is a collection of all 104 columns. Yes?
It's not coming up.
It's not coming up? Oh, I haven't hit the show the screen yet. No, I thought I did. Does anybody get it?
Yes, I do. I have it as well.
It's just taking a little while to get to New Mexico.
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments about the prayer? Well, let's go on then. And I don't have my bell.
I have one quick comment about the prayer.
Yes.
It was interesting that the word fundamentally kind of jumped out at me in that prayer, and my mind was putting it in its proper definition.
Okay, what is a proper definition?
Well, to me, fundamentally, is from the source, but, you know, it's just that it had that connotation of fundamentalist thinking that I had to...
Well, that's, of course, a distortion of the word, as you correctly point out. I always like to remember that fundamentals are the fun of the mental.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
So, Walden Grove is dedicated to the fundamentals, having fun learning about the mind. Good. Well, our first session in each one of these days is we explore a subject, a big idea, a subject of growth, of interest, at least to me. And hopefully to you. Our discussion topic this morning is what obstructs human growth? What obstructs human growth?
Fear.
Rose has suggested fear. Any other contribution? Maybe fear accelerates human growth.
Well, the fear of the unknown.
Fear of the unknown.
Or people don't want to rock the boat, even if their life might be miserable, at least.
It's their life.
They're used to it.
Okay.
So change freaks some people out.
Freaking out a whole lot of people right now. Other ideas here. What obstructs human growth? I'm sorry?
How about patience?
How does patience obstruct?
No. Expectations.
Oh, expectations.
Correct. They're not always great expectations. So I think that what we expect from time, but it's just a matter of being very, very open.
Well, you're going to need to give me an example of what you mean here.
Oh, I think that we expect certain things of life because of the lack of our understanding of life and spirit. And so because our expectations are limited, we limit our growth.
Okay, so let me rephrase that, if you wish, if you will. Self-imposed limitations.
Exactly.
Where do we get these self-imposed limitations from?
Well, that would go back, to some fears that Rose just mentioned, but to do it. It can also go back to the way we were brought up, the way a child is raised.
Okay.
But it comes from those, earlier experiences can do that.
Well, we always have to keep in mind that it takes a village to stop growth in a child. Other comments. What obstructs human growth?
I was going to say inertia.
I'm sorry?
Inertia or laziness.
Okay.
And I'm thinking in terms of inertia just being a habit of not doing anything.
Okay. Okay, trapped in the status quo.
Yes.
Whatever that might be, as Rose points out, it could be misery, but it's status quo, so you defend it. All right. Other contributions?
Defensiveness.
I don't know about that. Please, go ahead and expiate on defensiveness. Okay. All right. I think what you're describing here is too much of a belief system grounded in survivalism of the me versus them construct that leads to conflict. That I have to grab for all the gusto I can because nobody else will do it for me. And that results in defensiveness, ego, circling the wagons around the ego, etc. Sure. Anybody else?
Going back to if a child is raised with certain attitudes and beliefs and not clearing that up once they become an adult.
Yes, absolutely. Sure. Okay, let's approach it. Yeah, you have another.
Well, this would just be what Dorothy was saying. I actually know someone whose parents told them that they were just fine the way they are, and if other people didn't appreciate that, well, they just would have to deal with it because that's the way you are, and, you know, you don't have to change.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're with all your rotten habits or whatever. I mean, that's terrible.
Yes. So we get trapped in our the sponge of triviality that I talked about. Well, let's approach this from a different point of view. What is the source of the impulse to grow? What is the impulse to grow? What's its source?
I would say it's the soul with its pride.
The pride of the cattle pride of the soul. Okay. Any
or spirit.
I'm sorry?
A light to pride.
Yes.
A well lit pride.
That's good.
There must be a joke in here somewhere off of The Devil Wears Prada, but it's escaping me right now. Why do we have a conscious sense of the impulse to grow, at least in our latter stages of growth, and say dogs and cats don't?
Well, if it's in the latter stages, it's because we've built part of the Anacarana. We've built a link.
Building a link, yeah. I think you have to recognize the impulse to grow before you start building the Anacarana.
Yeah, you said in the later stages.
Yes. Anybody else? You're hard to hear.
I'm sorry. I have the mic right next to my mouth, but just let me know. Whenever you ask that question, my first thought was back to the mind of God at that first moment of creation.
Uh-huh.
So, I think to me that was the reason for creation. You know, it all expanded and with God.
Uh-huh. Okay. Oh, I know the problem. Yes. Yes. Okay. Somebody was looking for recognition? Okay, need to know is a way, but the need to know is a manifestation of the impulse to grow, not the source. Let me sum up go ahead if somebody has something.
I was just going to say the light, as you said earlier, but we're being drawn, we're being called, we're being drawn.
Summoned.
Summoned. Yes.
Okay. Well, obviously, the source of the impulse to grow, I think we can identify as a divine force that's part of our nature that awakens and impels us, and that the source of stagnation and inertia is the heaviness of matter here on the physical plane, which doesn't normally affect us except when we're in incarnation. According to DK, the impulse to grow was instigated 18 million years ago. You remember that? I remember it like it was yesterday. Through the formation of the Temple of Ibez, I-B-E-Z, Ibez, the Temple of Ibez, which was the original outpost of the hierarchy here on the physical plane. Somewhere, the first Temple of Ibez was somewhere in South America. It's rumored to be at the bottom of Lake Titicaca, which is high up in the Andes. They like the mountains. So this is the impulse that motivates civilization to grow and develop. And what we have to understand, of course, is that the real clue to this answer lies in terms of the source of the impulse to grow, is that it's an ongoing impulse that is directed into humanity periodically from the hierarchy. It comes from the hierarchy, which embodies the human impulse to grow. And you've read in DK, or you've heard me talk about the fact that over the last 500 years or so, every 100 years around the 25th year of each century, in other words, 1525, 1625, 1725, etc., the hierarchy has instigated a higher, stepped up the impulse to grow to stimulate civilization's development. And individually, we are members of humanity, so we derive our impulse to grow from humanity, from the hierarchy. And that occurs through the connection with the soul, but it's through the hierarchy. So what keeps this impulse to grow alive today? Okay. Rose?
This is along that line, but I was thinking that probably part of it would be that having worked with this energy, that it has been grounded to a certain degree, so there's some sort of critical mass that then helps us continue interacting and helps others become aware of the impulse to grow.
Okay. Of course, that critical mass is balanced by the critical ass. I'm using this in the technical esoteric sense. Here.
Of course, I understand.
I think a good example of what you're talking about is freedom, which 500 years ago didn't exist anywhere on the face of the earth in the sense that it does today. It was emerging slowly in England and a few other places. Now we have this recognized as an ideal throughout the world, although only about 75% of the world's population live in any degree or measure of freedom. But we have people who understand the light of freedom, the flame of freedom, and nurture it, and then there are those who seek to distort it for their own selfish gain. So that's why I'm talking about critical mass versus critical ass. So this is the war of ideas. The war of ideas may change from time to time, but the conflict in terms of growth and retrogression is fought daily at the astral level. So how is the impulse to grow spread? Uh, what should be spread through churches and education, churches and schools, as we teach the principles of divine law in the churches, and we teach the principles of enlightenment in the schools. However, I'd say I would give both of those institutions failing marks in terms of keeping the impulse to grow alive and spreading it. It has spread in spite of their better efforts, not because of it.
Would you say something like capitalism? I mean, I know that often turns into greed.
Well, I think trade and commerce,
yeah,
is, to take it out of the realm of ideology,
mm-hmm.
Trade and commerce have done a lot. Science has done a certain amount, although it imposes some limitations.
Okay. And then just in your own life, as you try to make life better, that would be a response to the impulse to grow, wouldn't it?
Well, certainly as you learn to educate yourself, not rely on schools or church, but as you learn to think for yourself and read and devour information, the media would be a great vehicle for spreading this, but it trivializes everything and sensationalizes and makes everything petty. And so, for example, we have a serious debate about spending in this country, but the media can only focus on the clash between Obama and Boehner. It becomes personalized, trivialized, etc. And so people have missed the point. The point is that we need to think hard about what it means to be financially responsible. The media trivializes that. Our forms of mass entertainment totally misrepresent it. But intelligent people form a network or a connection that fuels ongoing growth. Rose was reading me a article from The Daily yesterday, which was talking about the fact that within the scientific community, which as a whole tends to debunk anything out of the ordinary or anything slightly imaginative, there is a group, a shrinking but nonetheless a group that has been working for 30 years to explore anything out of the ordinary, including psychic stuff. They're doing a poor job of it, but at least these are scientists, all of them PhDs and well-known in their fields, who are coming together and exploring what science, normal mainstream science normally considers to be out of the ordinary. And so there is the spark of there's always people who are willing and able to preserve the impulse to grow, even in the face of ridicule, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I think how do we best neutralize the forces of diversion, dissipation, and deceit? Well, they taught them the value of cheating.
Of course, of course. You know, it helped them use a lesson that probably was for the kids. I mean, it's okay if our teachers and superintendent will do anything for us to pass, we'll cheat.
Well, it corrupts a whole generation or more into believing that in order to get ahead, you have to cheat. And that's expected of you. The I think the real story here, and it may be too early to tell this. It may be when in a month you would be better able to respond to this. Maybe Dorothy can respond or somebody else. But I wonder whether in any state of the union, teachers are being encouraged this fall to talk about the problem of cheating to their students. And to take this as an opportunity to learn at the expense of the tragedy of Georgia.
I haven't heard about taking it as a lesson to the students, but here in Baltimore, for the first year left this past year, the superintendent had monitors come in so that if there was any cheating going on, the monitors were overseeing the tests and the assessments. And I forget the exact scores, but only 15 out of 100 schools passed, as opposed to majority passing in years past.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it really is a reflection of cheating is happening.
Yes, I rather suspect that it's not just Georgia. Now, let me ask you this question. That's fascinating, but let me ask you the broader question. does monitoring tests, is that an effective way of eliminating cheating?
No.
Why?
I think that the problem in this institutionalized in a way that they may be able to get around the monitors eventually. It's not getting at the source of the problem.
Exactly. And what is the source? What is the source of the solution? Not the source of the problem, but the source of the solution. In any problem, let me back up and explain this a little bit. As we've talked about through all of the classes I teach you about, problems are not, the problem here is not the temptation to cheat. The problem is the lack of ethical restraint. The lack of a higher ethic which would remind the teachers that don't even think about it. And remind the students, don't even think about it. My background on this is, of course, as you know, I went to Dartmouth. They made this very clear. They stood up during the orientation week before we started school and said, we have a very strict policy about cheating here. And it is self-monitoring. If you cheat and you're caught, you will be expelled for at least 2 years. I knew one fellow who was expelled for 2 years because he borrowed a reference book from a library and kept it to himself. In other words, he permanently borrowed a reference book. And because it was a reserved book for reference only, it was deemed that he was cheating other students from the opportunity to use that book, and it was open and shut. He was expelled. And Dartmouth was very strict about that. If you cheated, you were gone. If you cheated and a fellow classmate realized you were cheating, it was expected that that fellow classmate would report you for your own good, not because Dartmouth people are a bunch of rats, but because you're not learning. You're cheating your parents out of all that hard-earned money for tuition if you cheat at Dartmouth. As a result of which, when a test was being administered at any level, the teacher would hand out the test and leave the room and go down to his office. There was no proctoring, no monitoring. Everybody was on their own. Cheating could have been rampant. I was never in 4 years aware of any instance of cheating, in any class that I participated in. It got to the point where teachers would had the option of just giving you the exam and saying, take it home, and whenever you have 2 hours, sit down and start the exam, and after 2 hours, finish and bring it back to me by such and such a date. So it wasn't even necessary to be in the room of the classroom in order to take the exam. You could do it at your own time. Everybody had the opportunity, if they wanted to have any resource open to them, but we were on our honor not to do so. And I don't know of anybody who ever did cheat that way. So the point I'm getting at is that cheating occurs in an absence of ethics, an absence of values. And the only solution to the problem is to teach those ethics and values and make them strong. Proctoring, monitoring the exam implies that you expect that the students would cheat if you weren't there. Hence, I'm completely against proctoring exams. I did it when I taught because I didn't know of any other alternative, but one of the purposes of Walnut Grove would be to instill from day one the idea that if you cheat, you're just impoverishing yourself. You're just stealing your childhood away from you. This is your opportunity to learn and become something. Don't waste it. And don't drag anybody else into it with you. Comment on that. I've talked too much.
Are you still on that?
Well, I understand that, but...
I mean, it doesn't make it okay to cheat. I agree.
Yeah. Obviously, we have to get rid of... Look, the teachers that are willing to cheat that way are not teaching their children anyway. They're the root problem. Not you. You teach. But any colleague that would be tempted to fudge results in order to get ahead is not teaching and shouldn't be a teacher. So we need to.
They are trying to get their own set of standards. So now, like maybe if the kid gets 20% of the pass, who knows?
Yeah.
Sad state of affairs that this testing has become just a monster, you know, really has. I mean, it's reflective of what you're saying, for teachers, of course. It's not even on all the teachers, it's on families that can educate their children, you know, from birth on.
So, well, again, this comes back to the point that our educational system is not inspired by the impulse to grow. It's inspired by outer appearances, by test scores, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, Rose.
Well, plus we test and test and test. We test at least 6 times when the children are exhausted. By the time you go through the last round of testing, they put anything down because they're. Yeah. And you hear that from many teachers that it's just the testing is phenomenal. I remember growing up, you know, we had our state test in New York, but it was once a year.
Sure.
You know, and if you were smart enough, they asked the same questions every year. But now it's ridiculous.
Right. Rose?
Are we still on the question of neutralizing?
Rose has the floor here.
Are we still on the question about neutralizing those three?
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Speak up so people can hear.
It seems like if you had a developed thinking mechanism, these would not be an issue. If you had clear vision and perfect understanding, division, deception, or dissipation and deception would not be an issue.
Right.
You would automatically try to draw things together for the division, dissipation. You would figure out where the hole was and plug it. And deceit, you would be working with the light of truth.
Mm-hmm.
So those wouldn't be issues. So the problem is people don't know how to think.
Right.
something that would seem like common sense to one person, another person just wouldn't have a clue
right.
that it was stupid what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Bill. Hard to hear you. Right. Okay. Good point. The teaching to the test is missing the point. Rose, you have another point?
Well, I was just going to say, I always thought Cliff Notes was cheating. I don't know. Do they still have those?
Cliff Notes? Do they still have them? They have the equivalent. You can go online and get anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
and that's
just
cheating. Exactly. I want to wrap this up because I've gone over the allotted time here for this. The idea is that the first 3 to 4 grades of elementary school should plant the seeds of honesty and intellectual integrity, not using those words, but getting the point across that each child must become his own master learner, and that shortcuts don't produce wisdom. They lead you to deceit and the wrong path. So this is an ethical question. Until humanity grows up a little bit and gets past this notion that it's okay to cheat if you can get away with it, that's a massive self-deception that defeats the impulse to grow. Okay, yes.
The sad thing is that testing is good, and it's not such a bad rap that children should be afraid of testing because it's a way of showing it for the teacher to see.
It's a form of communication, but it shouldn't be, should not be regurgitation.
Right.
My approach to testing is that testing is a valuable educational tool, but it's designed to tell the student what he knows or she knows, not the teacher or the parents. In other words, the act of taking the test is only half of it. The other half is reviewing it after the child has taken it. And I would go into a bunch of examples of this, but I've run out of time. So, there's the bell. End of class session. Oh, we are going on to the next class session. And just as soon as I can. All right. This is our next session each day of the 5 days of the class is going to study the 5 stages of literacy. And much is made of the ability to read. It's considered a basic fundamental skill of learning, although there's lots of ways you can learn without actually reading, but that's a different story. We will assume for the purposes of our discussion that the ability to read is central and fundamental to the ability to learn. It's not, but we'll assume that. That brings up the question, what is the value of reading if all that we end up reading as an adult is trash? Does the ability to read Solowinski's Rules for a Radical enrich us in any way, or does it impoverish us? Would it perhaps be better to remain illiterate than to fill our heads with such nonsense? And of course, I could have picked, to me, the ability to read Karl Marx is an utter waste of time and energy, and yet many colleges and high schools devote quite a bit of time to doing so. As I have, and in fact, as we'll discuss later on today, is the ability to study the history of war a useful way of using your ability to read? Just a few rocks to drop into your pond. Anyway, as I have been known to say, there are five stages of literacy, and these are very important to Walden Grove. The first stage of literacy is the ability to recognize words and sentences, i.e. read, and see what's on the page. The second stage is the ability to discern meaning from these words. The third is the ability to read between the lines, as they say. And the fourth stage is the ability to associate what you read between the lines with related ideas and allegory. And then the fifth stage is the ability to tap the power at the root of an idea. Stages 4 and 5 enable you to start thinking fifth dimensionally. So stage 1 is the ability to recognize words and sentences, literal reading of letters. Second stage is the ability to discern the meaning of those letters and words accurately. To know what you have just read. The third stage is the ability to read between the lines. That is a fourth dimensional activity. The fourth stage is the ability to read above the lines, which is a fifth dimensional activity, and associate freely with related ideas. And then the fifth stage is the ability to tap the power of the idea, which is nuclear. We're going to examine word recognition today, and the others one per day through the 5 days of the class. Now, word recognition is something that most of us take for granted, except teachers who struggle to teach children. Some children learn to read almost instantly with very little effort. Others make a huge melodrama out of the process of learning to read. But as adults, we take it for granted, and in our day and age, we're absolutely surprised when we run into somebody who can't read at all. But as I've just suggested, not all children are equal in their ability to recognize words and interpret them. The problem of dyslexia is a good example. A dyslexic, there are various kinds of dyslexia, but the brain, this is a brain function, and it fails to, the sensory perceptive devices in the brain, the sense organs fail to recognize the correct order of letters in a word. Now, my older brother was dyslexic, so I have some understanding of this. But a dyslexic can read a word correctly and then see it again in the next paragraph and have no idea what it stands for, because the brain is now rearranging the order of the letters. And this is just a mark of uncontrolled creativity. After all, if you see the word cat, well, the same letters could spell the word act. And it's just a different variation. Who says that you have to read from left to right? The Jews and the Arabs read from right to left. that's an older alphabet system and reading system than English. And who indeed says that you can't read from the middle outward? So if the word is cat, C-A-T, why not recognize it as A-C-T? But that's very confusing to a young 6-year-old trying to learn to read. And we have to keep in mind that to the adult, reading is automatic. To the child, this is bewildering. Where did these 26 strange characters come from anyway? And we have to keep in mind that lettered alphabets are fairly new to humanity. Even today, some languages are more glyphic than lettered. Chinese, Japanese, to some degree Arabic. Of course, the ancient Egyptians used hieroglyphs. We now chuckle about how inferior those alphabets were. Runes, the Nordic runes. But letter recognition is not a mental capacity, it's a question of training the brain. And again, if the brain hasn't been taught adequate coordination of incoming senses, sensory perceptions, the brain may have difficulty learning to read and putting things together. It's not so much that it's difficult to memorize 26 letters and understand how to pronounce them. The question is sequence. The problem arises when you put letters together and form words, and then you have to be able to sound out and interpret the words. We have to keep in mind that language skills, all languages develop orally, and dyslexics don't have any trouble speaking. They hear the language, they speak. It's just when they are asked to translate that into letter forms and letter recognition, they have trouble both reading and writing. But reading requires assembling letters into words and discerning the meaning of those words. So we need to approach this problem and issue. What is the purpose of language? Anybody? Rose got it in one word, communication. That's the purpose of language, to communicate, to exchange ideas with other people so that they can more or less accurately gather what your meaning is. It's not an exchange of words, it's an exchange of meaning, of intent, of concepts, of ideas. So why doesn't everyone create his own secret language or code? Yeah. Both Mary and Rose got it right, again, in one. It would be pointless. It doesn't communicate. And one of the ways in teaching reading skills in Walden Grove is to recognize that children coming to school already know how to read. They may not know how to read text, but they know how to read signs and images and symbols. And, for example, they know how to, they can probably identify the logos of a Mercedes and a Jaguar and whatnot. They know street signs from driving around with their parents. They know many specialized languages from advertising. They probably know what, I'm sorry? Sure, they know what the golden arches mean and so on. And so children are very, very easily pick up on these things. But then we throw them a real curveball. We ask them to learn written and learn how to read and write language. So, One way to help them with that is to encourage them to develop their own code, to help them the idea of a rebus, where you turn words into pictures and you have fun with this. You take the panic factor out of, you know, we all talk about math anxiety. There's also letter anxiety. My God, what is all this gibberish written down on the page? So in order to understand this, we need to understand what are the roots of words in any language? How are words manufactured in English or Spanish or Chinese? Anybody? I don't know.
Well, there in a lot of
that's true. There was no word in Oriental languages for freedom until just the last couple hundred years. It was a Western concept fomented in Greece. There was no word for freedom. One can speculate that there are dozens and dozens and almost infinite number of divine qualities that we don't even think about because we have no words to describe them. And this is one of the problems that we'll run into when we talk about ethics with Aristotle. So how are words manufactured?
I'm just thinking it goes back to the need for communication. So focusing in on being able to communicate something, so you manufacture a word to do that.
Okay, that adequately describes slang, but it doesn't necessarily define or describe the origin of individual languages.
Have something to do with the imagination?
Probably not. What am I not communicating to you? All right, yes. And how are words manufactured from those roots? Well, let me give you an example. I taught Spanish, so I'm sorry?
Are you trying to get from a root word and then
No, that's far too grammatical for me. I'm trying to figure out how words evolve in a language. How does the word smile develop? How does the word laugh develop? What inspired somebody years and years ago to come up with the word smile? Let me give you an example here.
Somebody drew a happy face.
Somebody drew a happy face. I think the happy face came after the word smile. Not really. Not really, but that's a good guess. That's a good starting point. I'm going after Indo-European, thank you.
Oh.
Let me give you the example of Spanish, since that's what I'm familiar with. Spanish is an oral language based on Latin. The Roman Empire conquered Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, and occupied it for quite some time. And, of course, Latin was spoken, and from that Latin base, Spanish developed, especially with the influx of Arabic words during the occupation by the Moors that went from the 7th century to 1492 when Isabel and Ferdinand kicked the Moors out. And so in Spanish you have words like el, libro, L being the pronoun, that's Arabic in origin. But libro is Latin. So it's a dialect of Latin that relates it to Italian, French, English, Romanian, and so on. But spellings are based on a peculiarly Spanish sound. This was a language that developed without being written down very much for hundreds of years. Now, in Spanish, verbs all end in either IR, ER, or AR. Those are the infinitive forms. And are conjugated by dropping the ending syllable, the IR, the ER, or the AR, and substituting a new suffix depending upon who's doing the action. So a word like crear, which means to believe, becomes creo, I believe. See, C-R-E-A-R, they drop the A-R, and it becomes creo. You add an O, which is for I, and the word creo conveys the entire concept that one word conveys the concept of two words in English, I believe. In English, we take the problem differently and we keep believe the same and we just change the subject. I believe, you believe, he believes, we believe, they believe, everybody doubts. But this is where problems arise in Spanish because they have a verb, the verb meaning to go is ir, I-R. And if you drop the ending, I-R, there's nothing left. So this is a linguistic problem. It sounds odd in Spanish. To Spanish ears, it would be odd to say, oh, meaning I go. So they invent, by agreement, the actual episode of this invention is lost in the annals of history, but they invent a new root by adding the letter V. And so ear becomes voy, V-O-Y, I go. Va, you go. Von, they go. So the point I'm getting here, that you don't need to remember any of this. The point I'm getting here is that written Spanish is a transliteration of spoken Spanish. All languages start as oral traditions that get written down. Every child who enters school has the oral tradition of English pretty well in hand. They may need to practice their pronunciation because they have speech problems. They can go see meaning. But they can understand spoken English. They can speak English. At least so other children can understand them, if not parents. So our problem becomes one of how do we introduce them to the transliteration? Reading English is just the transliteration of hearing English. Writing English is just the transliteration of speaking English. We can get an idea about this from music. A musical score can be viewed as the written form of music, transliteration of the actual sounds, and you have notes and a scale instead of letters. This is the language of music, but one does not have to be able to read music in order to play or compose it. Humming is sufficient. It is the inner ear attuned to the rhythms of the higher mind that compose and play good music. So the ability to decipher letters help us communicate with others and read what they think. But the thoughts are not literally generated by the letters, they're just symbols for them. So let's have a little fun here. You, your spouse, and another couple go to dinner in a restaurant. The head waiter asks, how many are in your party? You can answer by holding up four fingers, unless you are missing one. That's effective communication. You could also alternatively say four, but then you might be surprised when everybody ducks expecting a golf ball to come crashing through the window. You can take his pad and write the number four in Arabic, or IV for Latin for, or you can spell out the word for, F-O-E-U-R, or you can make four slash marks on the page and communicate the idea of four. Or you can revert to Spanish and say cuatro. But let's look at the, so there are all these different ways of communicating.
You'd probably get a pretty bad table if you tried that.
Yeah. But let's look at the letters of four. You, if a child who doesn't know how to read, if you write up on the blackboard F-O-U-R, there are 24 different ways he can read that, or she. You can read it as four, or foru, frau, furo, fruo, furor, roof, ralph, rufo, rofu, arfo, arfuo, ofu, and another 12 as well. The point is that the child doesn't know that it, he needs to read it in the sequence you're writing it, F-O-U-R. Most children figure that out very quickly. But the dyslexic may read it uroth. Now, only one of these 24 combinations is a word. That seems very, very inefficient to me. We have four letters, we've combined them, and we've got one word out of 24 possibilities. Why don't we have a word, ofru? It could mean eat your peas, ofru. Don't know what that means, but it has a negative connotation to me. So the challenge to the young brain is to learn which of these 24 combinations actually is a word and why, and then what does it mean? And so one of the conclusions we must draw is that English has vastly more letters than we need. We could probably do an alphabet with just eight letters, two or three vowels and five consonants, and use them all. But part of the process of learning to read is learning to discard 23 possibilities and coming up with the one that actually makes a word.
I mean, I don't do this, so I don't know, but doesn't texting leave out just about everything?
Texting is a form of code.
Yeah.
Yeah, and children like to do that because it's their secret code, and only they and their select number of friends can interpret it. So letters, the recognition of letters and words builds through unpressured experience. Unpressured experience. Children learn to speak. Their parents aren't standing there with a whip saying, learn your vowels. Learn your consonants. Children learn in the unpressured environment of the first 5 years of their life, observing older siblings and parents talking and or watching TV, which is a curse. But then we take them into the school situation and we pressure them. You've got to learn this many words by tomorrow. And that works for many, many students, but we have to keep in mind that not all children have had experience in previous lifetimes of reading. Most have not. But there also has to be a motive to learn. A 15-year-old who is a bad reader can teach himself to read in a week or two if he suddenly discovers that his interest in cars and mechanics can be enhanced by reading books. So the question is finding out what the child wants to read and then encouraging them to read that as opposed to Dick and Jane and Spock. So we come back, as always, to the need to know that Louise talked about. It's the inquisitive student who must quickly learn, who most quickly learns to read, perhaps over the shoulder of his mother while helping an older brother. The primary element of teaching reading, therefore, is gentle repetition combined with great enthusiasm. And I can't overemphasize the ability to be enthusiastic. But there's this need to understand how overwhelming the problem may seem to some students. Those are the slow learners. They don't have to be slow learners. The fact that they're having trouble deciphering English is not a lack of intelligence. My brother, the dyslexic, of course, was, my mother was told that he was a stupid kid by his teacher, but he went on and got 3 degrees from MIT and a doctorate from Cornell. So he wasn't stupid. He just was having trouble learning to read. Okay, as an exercise here, well, I'll take any comments or questions. Sure.
And you name the skin, the chalk and stuff. The kids, everybody in the class got to write the story because they all were able to just get the symbols they wanted. So the process was how do I tell a story, not how do I write all the words to the name of the class.
Right.
So, you know, it was very successful.
Well, I think that's important. I think children should be encouraged to explore glyphs and ideographs because, like that picture writing, because that gives them the confidence to communicate. And that is the purpose here.
Yeah, how can I communicate? How can I create?
Eventually, you take that and you convert it into word recognition, but the first step is to let them become aware that they can communicate on paper to other people. Other comments or questions? Well, I want you to take this idea then, and we'll have a little exercise here. I want you to draw a simple picture of something you wish to say. A picture, not words. Reduce the essence of what you want to say to an ideogram or a series of ideograms, and then into a series of letters that represent the picture. And if you have another person that you're taking the class with, some of you don't, but, show it to other people and see if they can understand what you're saying and how can you improve the resulting words so that others can understand it. Just do this. It's not difficult. Just draw something. Think of something you want to say. It could be as abstract as how, or it could be you're hungry or you're tired or whatever. Just something you wish to say. Reduce it, make an ideogram of it, a picture of it that becomes a formal ideogram or glyph, and then converts into a series of letters, and see if other people can understand what you're saying. The purpose of this exercise is to understand how language evolves and has evolved over a long period of time and how it should evolve in the consciousness of a young child. This is the end of my lecture, so we're going to have a break. It's 17 after 10. We're going to resume at 10:30 sharp, so don't be tardy. If you come up with some nice ideograms or whatever, pictures and ideograms, and want to email them to me, I'll try to put them up on the screen, if not right away, at least at lunch, and then we can talk about them. So just play with that a little bit, have a break, and we'll resume at 10:30.